right now I'm very happy to welcome to our program Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. And he's the author of 15 books, including The Whole World is Watching, Mass Media in the Making and Unmaking of the New Left, and Occupy Nation, The Roots, the Spirit, and the Promise of Occupy Wall Street. Todd is a former president of the activist group Students for a Democratic Society in 1963 and 64, and an organizer of the first national protest against the Vietnam War. He currently serves on the board of directors of the environmental group Greenpeace USA, and we're very glad that Todd Gitlin could join us tonight to discuss his recent article, How to Reverse a Slow-Motion Apocalypse, Why the Divestment Movement Against Big Energy Matters. Welcome to our program, Todd. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So we have climate change, I think, in many ways coming into evidence daily with the reports that are omnipresent of severe weather events that have, I think, given increasing visibility to the issues of global warming, triggering more concern, and in some ways overcoming the well-financed campaign by the fossil fuel industry to sow doubt about the causes and the solutions, how to address destructive climate change. But Todd, maybe I could get your take on that initial premise, whether public perception is changing about the global weather patterns and why we're having it.
Well, it's always in flux, and we don't have very... it's to be expected that there would be some volatility in those numbers. But what remains true and shocking is that, according to public opinion polls, something like 39% of Americans still don't know that climate change is happening and that it has primarily human causes. There's still sufficient misinformation and refusal, I would say, to face reality. Nonetheless, that's the country we're in, and we have to do our work in that setting. So we have to figure out some way to parlay our strengths into actual changes in policy. And I think the focus needs to be on the fossil fuel corporations that are the primary obstacle to a sane energy and climate policy.
One thing about the perception and the science in that, you know, we know there's a well-financed campaign to sow doubt in the public mind about what climate change is it real, who's causing it, et cetera, et cetera. But I've noticed that insurance companies take it very seriously, right? The guys doing the actuarial tables will tell you that climate change is real, and they're preparing for it in terms of their rates and the risk factors and people building, you know, houses near the shoreline and the like. Also, the Pentagon. From what I understand, the Pentagon is well into planning for crises that may evolve from climate change, whether it's drought, food shortages, unrest, movements of populations trying to get water or arable land. I mean, all these things seem to pile up, but as you said, Americans are, at least a portion of the population, remains skeptical.
Well, the insurance companies are interesting. I mean, they make money by being realistic. There's no money to be made in insurance through delusion or fairy tale. And so there's a certain sort of hard-headedness that's incumbent upon them. And since they are in the business of assessing risk, their ability to do their business, let's say selling flood insurance or something of that sort, is that business would crumble if they weren't realistic. So the problem is how to get the rest of the world to be as realistic as they must be, because actuarial tables and risk tables have a certain hard, you know, material irreversible nature. They you can't wish them away.
Yeah, and I think maybe in the public mind they might even have more credibility than scientists in academia, right?
Well, you know, attitudes toward science come and go. A lot of people think that because scientists change their minds that science doesn't work. I mean, there are things science doesn't work for, but Of course scientists change their minds. The scientific procedure is to assess evidence and to come up with better ideas when old ideas fail. And there's no resting point. There's no objective of final fix, certain truth. There is only, you know, better science. And so, of course, there are going to be errors and calls for revision along the way. That doesn't, if it weren't so, then science would not be science. It would be some sort of frozen dogma.
Right. No, that's a great explanation of what science really is. But, Todd, before we get to some of the particulars about the divestment campaign targeting energy companies, I wonder if you talk about the emergence of some new and exciting groups and overall movement developing around climate change. 350.org mentioned in your article, a lot of people coming together in this country and outside the borders of the U.S. targeting the Keystone XL pipeline as, you know, if not a sort of a tangible, real place to begin making a stand on climate change, at least a very important symbolic one at the moment.
Well, I think what's happened over the last 5 years or so is a recognition on the part of people who recognize that climate change is taking place and that it's potentially catastrophic, a kind of recognition that they have failed to deliver the necessary change by appealing to the government to pass the right regulations, because the obstacles are, at least have been, insuperable. The lobbying, the disinformation, the campaign financing, and so on by the fossil fuel companies has thrown up a brick wall. So if the government under present conditions is frozen, then where do you look for leverage? And you look for leverage someplace where you can actually imagine a change that cascades into larger changes. And that's, I think, the sort of the rubric under which the most interesting elements of the climate change movement are operating. One of them has to do with calling public attention to and trying to obstruct the development of fossil fuel intensive developments like the shipping of the tar sands from Alberta to the southern U.S. For shipment to China, plans to expand coal mining and so on, attempts, in other words, acts of civil disobedience and popular campaigns to get political support for at least not worsening the current climate situation. The second promise is, so that's, you know, the various movements to stop the Keystone pipeline and other sorts of pipelines, I think, are very much apropos. But the second development that's kind of mushroomed in the last year is the attempt to get public boards or private boards, could be cities, could be public pension funds, and I think most widespread university investors to divest from fossil fuel corporations. Not because there's some naive belief that nobody will buy the shares that they sell, but rather because the idea is to underscore in the public mind that these corporations have a business model which is contrary to human survival. Their business depends on excavating more and more fossil fuels out of the air and dumping more and more carbon into the atmosphere, which is a road to doomsday. So the idea of trying to get a university to divest from these companies is not built on any delusion about the dollar value here. It's built on the belief that at a time when most people doubt that business and government are actually capable of doing the right thing, that here might be another institution which can shine a light on unsavory practices and sort of declare with with drama and, you know, with crashing cymbals, that that there's something that can actually be done to further the good and to retard the bad. That is to label these companies as destructive, and to suggest that that they need to be shown, they need to be understood the way we understand tobacco companies, namely as institutions that have a stake in public disease.
Thanks for that, Todd. We're speaking with Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University, author of 15 books, and he's here talking about his recent article, How to Reverse a Slow-Motion Apocalypse, Why the Divestment Movement Against Big Energy Matters. Todd, in your article, How to Reverse a Slow-Motion Apocalypse, you talk about the relative financial impact on the oil industry, the fossil fuel industry, from a campus-based divestment campaign. But you talk about it in terms of the long-term and the short-term and the long-term, discussing a cascading effect that we've seen before and things like the South African apartheid divestment movement years ago. Maybe you could sort of detail what you think is going to be happening here if it all works out like the organizers would like.
Well, we know from the South Africa case and also from tobacco that when a group of institutions declare that a certain kind of investment is an investment in suffering, in unnecessary suffering, that they can actually pull other institutions with them, and that the sense of things changes. I mean, it's quite fashionable these days to say, well, Americans are used to guzzling fossil fuels and won't give up their vehicles and so on. But think about how the public feeling about smoking has changed just in the last, you know, 20 years. I mean, it's really remarkable that smoking, which was once a sign of hipness, is now, you know, a sign of irresponsibility. And this began with mobilizing the power, the prestige of medical practitioners, making the profession stand up with a common statement. And the statement was, smoking is hazardous to your health. And that, through a thousand or million channels, has become a sort of common sense. So the new common sense that the divestment movement proposes is that these companies have a stake in making the world, making the planet uninhabitable. And that is obviously crazy and needs to be, you know, and needs to be understood as an obstacle to human progress. So even and moreover, the divestment movement makes financial points that are, I think, deserve to be taken seriously. It's been calculated that in the year 2012, the top 200 fossil fuel companies in the world sank $647 billion, that's billion with a B, $647 billion into finding and developing new resources, new coal, new oil, new gas. That $647 billion has been gambled by those companies on the premise that the world will permit them to burn it. The world will permit the combustion to go on. And it's therefore a bet on the incompetence and stupidity of humanity. That is not something that a university that has a stake in truth should be enamored of. And so if the world actually comes to its senses, it will quickly become clear that the fossil fuel industry is not actually a shrewd judge of its own long-term interests, but is actually a poor judge of it. And that's sort of some of the thinking also behind the fossil fuel industry, that there are many serious people. I just read an article to this effect in the Financial Times, who believe that the fossil fuel companies are actually making stupid decisions, and that they would actually not be good investments for that reason.
I've read that thus far, 8 small colleges and nearly 24 towns and cities have pledged to sell their shares in fossil fuel companies. But you point out in your article that the economic impact can really exponentially grow if pension funds and state-issued bonds would be part of the picture in terms of divestment. You see the groundwork being laid down now for that eventuality? You think that can
happen?
Yeah,
I do. This movement has moved with great velocity, and so it's true, only a few small liberal arts colleges have divested so far, but a number of cities have declared their intention to do so. A number of large investment pools, pension fund pools in California and elsewhere, have said that they're looking askance at these investments. There are now my alma mater, Harvard, has a very active student campaign, and with an alumni wing and so on, that is urging people, alumni and faculty and others, not to donate to Harvard's official campaign, but to invest instead in an escrow fund that won't be released until there is divestment from the top 200 fossil fuel corporations. And the thing is catching on. I mean, there are more and more people talking about it. But it's not a sure thing. I don't think anything's a sure thing. But I do think there is a momentum here, and it is now, I think, the fact that at a number of schools, including Harvard, there have been a referenda on the part of the student bodies that are overwhelmingly in favor of divestment. 70-80% of the population. Yale just had, I think, an 83% figure for in students opting for divestment. So there's something of a shifting mood here, that at the very least, that something can be done, and that students can put their fingers on a hinge, on a sort of a place where the larger need meets the immediate territory. And the immediate territory is the university. The bigger need is to arrest the human-caused climate change. Perhaps if we can move the university here, we can magnify the effect. We can gain leverage. And that, I think, is a plausible strategy. We know that it worked in the case of South Africa. We know that the combination of divestment and sanctions actually helped drive the apartheid government to its knees and to end its domination of that part of the world. There's really no dispute about that. So we think that that's a model that can be emulated.
Todd Gitlin, in your article, you point out that the children of fossil fuel corporations might have some very uncomfortable questions for their fathers or mothers who were in the industry. And
yeah.
I've always wondered, in terms of the concern of these fossil fuel executives for the next generation. Obviously, many of them have children. They have grandchildren. I don't think they're out to destroy the human race by any means. But it seems like they compartmentalize, like I guess a lot of folks do, their actions at work versus their concern for their own flesh and blood. How do we get that disconnect? And I'll just make, kind of a brief comparison. We were talking about tobacco companies before. If a tobacco executive 30 years ago, had the public face that smoking cigarettes had no connection to cancer, emphysema, et cetera, he could always go home and tell his kids not to smoke, right, privately, and say,
yeah,
hey, look, I might say this on Capitol Hill, but I'm telling you, don't smoke this stuff. I know what it does. They don't have that same kind of option for sort of familial action. They can't do anything independently of where the planet's going with climate change. So it just seems totally, I don't know. I can't understand it.
Well, people have all kinds of ways of protecting themselves from their better judgment and their wiser understanding. And I don't know. I don't think anybody knows how the parents who are involved in fossil fuel industries will react when their kids start saying, you know, you're condemning me to a life of anxiety and you're condemning many people we don't know around the world who live, you know, in Bangladesh below sea level and so on to really impossible circumstances because you're short-sighted. I don't know how they're going to react, but I think it would certainly concentrate the mind of these executives to know that so far as their children are concerned, the purpose of the business is not simply to give them large inheritances, but is to actually improve life. And this is a foolish way to attempt it. And it's something of an intuition of mine, not any sort of certain knowledge, that this will eventually be fought out as, at least in part, as a generational fight between those who are mindful of long-term consequences and those who, whatever their professed intentions, don't yet understand how dangerous is the game they're playing.
Well put. Lastly, I just wanted to touch on the political system. As you talk about in your article, the fossil fuel corporations finance the climate change deniers' handbook and advertisements and all manner of outreach to the public to confuse the issue deliberately, it seems to me. And we have a political system that it certainly allows that to occur without much in the way of consequences. And as you wrote about it in Occupy Wall Street, there's a recognition by many people today, and a lot of young people, of course, who think our political system is broken, that it's corrupt, and it can't respond responsibly to a crisis like climate change. And it seems to me that that's certainly a part of this. I guess I agree with you. We have great hope that a movement will evolve and grow to the point where it can overcome the obstacles of our quote-unquote democratic system. But it seems to be a huge obstacle at this point.
It is a huge obstacle. I mean, the climate crisis is, in no small measure, these companies. And they have organized ways of controlling the political system through donations, through lobbying, through disinformation, through subsidy, which secures their power. Nonetheless, there's no certificate that entitles them to rule forever. They rise and fall. They have their own economic fragilities. They have their own anxieties, even panics. They have their own deficiencies, and you know, they suffer. You know, it takes one BP oil spill to remind people that, you know, one doesn't want to be beholden to these companies, and that they actually need to be contained or more. And you know, we don't know very much about how consciousness changes, but what we do know is that tenacity, vigor, ingenuity, long-term thinking, all these pay off. I just read a book about the ending of the slave trade in Britain. In 1787, a campaign was launched to prevent the slave trade, and it was the work of a dozen individuals who had powerful moral sentiments, but they were freaks and kooks so far as the larger society was concerned, and they were able to turn the moral compass somehow so that their cause became a vastly popular cause. And within 20 years, they actually made this apparently impossible thing happen. Although all along the way, there were arguments to be made. There were always arguments in behalf of established systems, and there were arguments to be made about the economic merits of the slave trade. And yet they were able to prevail. They were able to get hold of the levers that were available and to turn their moral passion into a victorious crusade. So obviously that doesn't happen. There's no guarantee that history works that way, but it is, you know, one has to decide whether one is willing to, you know, take part in such a possibility, even without a guarantee, or whether one is simply shrugging one's shoulders and leaving matters to the institutions that have actually jammed us into the fix we're in. You know, and people will make those judgments differently, and they'll assign different weights to the different considerations that they face. But there are always, and I think I take heart in the fact that there are growing numbers of people who think that the future that's been organized for them by our existing institutions with respect to climate change is simply too damn risky, too damn destructive to want to be party to.
Well, Todd, we're out of time. I thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on climate change and the divestment movement with our audience tonight. And thank you for all your activism and hard work and research and books over the years. We appreciate you being on our program tonight.
Well, we all do what we can. Thank you for giving me the voice.
Thanks, Todd. Good night.
Take care.
Bye-bye. That's Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University, author of 15 books, and activist from way back when, former president of Students for a Democratic Society in the early 60s, SDS, and still active on the scene today.